Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Please pray with me. Oh, Heavenly Father.
Oh, Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Babaji.
Babaji.
Lahari Mahasya.
Lahari Mahasya.
Swami Sri Yukteswarji.
Swami Sri Yukteswarji.
Paramahansa Yogananda.
Paramahansa Yogananda.
Dearest Mother.
Dearest Mother.
Saints and sages of all religions.
Saints and sages of all religions.
I bow to all of you.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Lovely to be back in Sunnyside, and looks to be a brand new house. Familiar yet new. It's beautiful with the candles out in the front. So nice. Promised you I'd tell you a story. I tell the story because some may be interested in it from a personal standpoint, but there's also a moral in it. So. You have to watch out. During this last spring and summer, I started to get an inner prompting that concerned Carla and marriage. I just kind of sat with that. It was not something that was on my mind. In fact, before that, it seemed that the life that I had, even though it didn't entail taking vows of never getting married or anything like that, it seemed like that was probably the way my life would go. That's what I thought. And so this inner prompting started to come, and I sat with it, and I meditated on it, and I went deeper with it. It seemed to get stronger, and I analyzed it to see its origins. Was it coming out of personal desire? Was it coming out of loneliness? Was it coming out of something, some other kind of human need, or was it divine direction? To all my ways of testing it and thinking about it, that the direction seemed to be coming from God. I spent a lot of time with myself, and I think I know myself fairly well, and I know the different caverns and the different parts of me and what desire natures are there and what desire natures are not there. And so as that kept on in persistency and consistency, I took it to Larry. And I said, "What do you think, Larry?" Being another of Mother's ministers and somebody who I trust to give me honest appraisals and opinions, and also somebody that I respect as a spiritual God-man. He was most enthusiastic over the idea. I thought, well, that's interesting. But what to do next? So in good Indian fashion, I decided to consult an astrologer. the mother had liked. Her name is Jerry Mackus, and she's been reading astrology for quite some time. And I thought, well, it'd be interesting to get a take on that. So during one of my visits up, I had set up an appointment with her, and she gave a reading, and she was overjoyed at the prospect of this match, that we were in the house of friendship together, that we were in the house of love together, and thought that it was the perfect thing, and just was very effusive. And but the sweetest part was at some point toward the end, she kind of looked off to the side, and suddenly she just got this most beatific look on her face and the sweetest of smiles. And she said, "Mother is with you all the time, isn't she?" I said, "Yes." And that was it. But it was just a lovely moment. Lovely moment. One that I treasure in my memory. So I thought, well, that's interesting. Another piece in the puzzle that's there. But I don't, I knew it was a very large decision. I knew that it was fraught with, you know, possible subterfuge on my own ego's side. And so I wanted to take it to a higher source still. Not that Larry's not a great
one. You know that I would do it.
So I wrote to Swami Satchitananda, and I said, "Here's my inner prompting." And I said, "I leave it completely to you that Mother had taught us that there are three ways to confirm an intuition. One is it supported in the scriptures? The other is there some God-man who confirms it for you, or some realized soul? And the third way is a prophecy fulfilled. In other words, if you get an intuition, does it come to fruition? Does it actually happen?" And that's a third kind of confirmation that you can get for your own intuition. You might say it's a little bit after the fact, you know, it doesn't confirm something for you before, but it does let you begin to know whether you're on the right track or not, and whether your intuition is operating correctly or not. So I wrote to Swamiji, and I said, "Here has been this inner prompting. And if you say no, that the mother had taught us to have it confirmed with God-man, and if you say no, that's it, I drop it. And if you say yes, then I'll take that as confirmation from God." And so he wrote back and said that he was surprised, but that he was delighted, and that there was nothing in a householder's life that prohibits one from God realization. And he had a quote, a wonderful quote from Papa. And so that was, you know, a picture starting to coalesce, all these things. But still, I felt it was important, and I wanted, I took that as very strong confirmation, but still I wanted something from God that really nailed it down for me. And so, of course, I'd been presenting it before God, but I said, "God, you have to confirm this in a way that it absolutely makes it clear without any question of a doubt that this is your will." And so there's three events. One was an inner event. Actually, all three were inner events. But one was a wonderful experience that I had that lifted me up, and it just became crystal clear that this was God's will, that this is the way that things were supposed to proceed. The second was a clear presence and intuition of Mother, and that she came and she confirmed it absolutely and was delighted and very happy about it. The third was an experience that remains very hallowed. Those are wonderful experiences also, but this one in particular is very hallowed in my thoughts and my memory. And as I sat in my hermitage cabin, and there was many days when I hardly moved from the cabin, I did my circumambulation of Om Sri Ram around in many days. That was the only time I ever left my cabin. And I sat in my chair and meditating and absorbed in God and feeling God's presence. And in my vision, with my eyes open, but in inner vision, I saw Mother out on the porch. And it's as real to my inner senses as anything to my outer senses. And so I closed my eyes, and when I opened my eyes again, she was there again, and I knew that somebody else was with her. So she came in, and we had some words together, and she indicated that somebody else was there. And then I closed my eyes, and I saw my inner vision, these deer skin covered feet. But the figure was immense. All I could see was the feet, and they're huge. And there was some figure of a person that extended beyond my own vision. And the word that came to me was Purushottama, which is an Indian word meaning the supreme being of the universe, the supreme personality of the universe. And you'll see Papa is oftentimes referred to as the Purushottama. And as this inner vision continued, I asked, as I began to realize that this was Master, this was Yogananda, and I asked him if he would appear in a form that I could see, be a whole of him, and as thrilling as it was to see the feet, and suddenly he came in a form that was more nice, you might say. He shrunk himself for my benefit, for my own vision, and we had a wonderful conversation, and I had many questions about different aspects, both about his life, about his work, and some things about my own work and my own life. One of them was around organization and what he formed and why he formed it. Was it the right thing that he did, form this large organization? And what he told me is that it was necessary in order to change the consciousness of the Western world. And that they had made some mistakes, but that he was glad and it was the right thing to do to go ahead and form this organization. He was also very glad that we were carrying on in a more traditional yogic type manner without the organization, one-to-one teaching in small groups, which is the traditional way that the teachings have been given. And it came to mind about this question around Carla, so I asked him about marriage. And he said that, yes, that he was very much in favor of it, that he had and does want this message to go out that there's this bias, I think, in the East in particular, but I think also in the West, that being in a married relationship is somehow a second-class citizen. You know, if somebody is a sannyasi or a renunciant on that level, that automatically kind of raises the status, and that Lahari Mahasya come, Babaji had directed him into a householder lifestyle, and that was very important, that example and that message go out, that there's nothing about a married life that inhibits. In fact, there are many things that are extremely beneficial about it. In the yogi path and in the path of realizing God. And that this inner direction that I was receiving was to be an example, to be a support, that there's nothing in marriage that inhibits one from being realized or gaining the realization. And with that information, that sealed it for me. That removed that last kind of hitch inside that I had, that doubt. I was wondering, is this the right thing to do or not? And I felt his blessings, and at the same time I felt Babaji's influence and his blessings on it as well. And that it's an important message, it's a timely message, it's something that the world is in need of, and I don't want to over-exaggerate my own influence, but that what each one of us does has an influence on the world. It has a way of pushing things in one direction or another. And that for whatever reason, these great masters and God have it in mind that this affirmation for the householder style, for man and wife, for marriage, be supported, and let that be something that come into the world and be an example. So that's how it came about. This occurred over many months, several months, all the time in silence, and just kind of a humorous, funny aspect. I don't know how you are. Once in a while, I'll pick up a book and I'll read from the back to the front. It's just a quirky thing that I do occasionally. And so, being in silence, you know, how do I communicate this? So, through written messages, Carla indicating what the inner direction was, and you need to plan these kinds of things, and a date came about. And so, all the planning, the marriage was occurring, all the places being reserved, deposits being made, and all the rest of it. And so that was occurring in the last couple of months while I was at Cloud Mountain. And I didn't feel like I could announce it to anybody because I hadn't asked her yet.
Well, who was doing all these arrangements?
Carla.
Oh.
She was consulting with me in writing, but she was doing all the arrangements.
So she didn't know that it was for writing?
She did, thought... and she knew it was hers.
Oh,
that would have been,
okay.
That would have been additional fun to, you know,
yeah,
I want you to make all these arrangements for
yeah.
writing. And,
but you had to ask her, yes?
But I wasn't speaking, so I couldn't ask her.
Yeah.
But I indicated through writing,
oh.
So she knew. She knew that way.
But what we all want to know, David, is when did you and Carla both know that you this
yeah.
is what you wanted?
Well, you'd have to ask Carla about
the
second.
I thought there was a moral. I thought the moral was going to be she said no when you...
Wrong moral. You're getting your intuition half taken away.
That was a clinker.
It was an intuition.
So I indicated in writing, and she, I think, enthusiastically accepted in writing, but that I hadn't asked her. So a few days after I left the silence, then I asked her, and she actually said yes. Lucky person that I am. So then, all the wedding arrangements are made, and then she said yes, and now we can start dating. So that's reading the book from the back to the
So you're leaving now and taking her to a movie.
My priorities haven't quite changed in So it was a lot of fun the way that it unfolded and the way that God did it. And very interesting. You know, you never know what's going to happen in this life. You never know. And I kind of had, when I was in India, Swamiji indicated, he says, you're a Swami, but you don't need the clothes. And there was actually another Swami who indicated the same thing. So what is it that a Swami is? A Swami renounces this world and is focused on fulfilling some kind of work besides their own realization. And I feel in spirit that the renunciation is there, and that the focus on the work is there, and that from that standpoint, my life doesn't change at all. That inner stillness, that inner place of operating and doing what we all do together is absolutely intact. It doesn't change whatsoever. So, I felt from the beginning, and I still feel, what is in here is the same. And I'm delighted, but I'm also surrendered to God's will, and whatever He chooses around it.
Can we hear something about the human aspect of this in terms of Carl and you? Did you know some sense of this?
In terms of, like,
beforehand, did you
some sense of,
intuition
you know,
that, or?
That you guys were more than friends or something? I mean, some sort of evolution here?
Well, we would just, I knew that I really liked working with David, and that I was committed to doing the work. I felt as though my Dharma was the work of Mother and David, and that through doing the work, and then the work that he always did with me was always very professional, and but we became friends through the course of the work, and then for me it was there was an attraction, but he clearly made it clear that was not what his inner prompting was. He always made that very, very clear to me. So I obviously had a choice, you know, and my choice was that I knew that this was the way, that this path, that Mother's teachings, David's teachings, were the way to my own God realization. And that was and continues to be the most important thing to me. So I made the choice that part was to be put aside, and I completely surrendered that. Once that complete, utter surrender happened, then at some point in time, he started to write to me about the inner prompting that he was doing.
But no, he's kind of seemed like his personal secretary, you know, this girl Friday. It's like, we could always go to Carla if
you need anything about David or anything. Carla's done a beautiful job with that. Mm-hmm. From the time I was in India, mm-hmm. and even before she was doing work. And so, yeah.
I can see you too easily as another Mother Krishna body around you.
Well, we have some work to get there. it's very nice, though. It's very nice. That's certainly a life of service.
Mm-hmm.
A life of dedication toward this work, and bringing the light, however God expresses it through us, is just both of our aim and goal and the center of our lives. There's just nothing else more important than that. Mm-hmm.
Greg helped me remember the intuition of that, and it's kind of fun to share, because I remember when Carla first came, I thought she would be a nice girlfriend for David, and I thought about it in...
Imagine that, trying to hook me up.
Me! And I was meditating on it, and Mother's voice came and said, I think that would be nice. I think that would be nice. I like that one. And that was about 3 years ago, and it was very clear timing that it would be. Mm-hmm. So it was fun to...
And Jill told me about that, and I said, well, I just don't have any sense of that at all. And she said, well, I guess it'll be a good test of my intuition. And it has been.
It's been a fun one.
Yeah. So I think one of the... the messages that came through so strongly to me is this idea of the householder path, the way of marriage just being validated, and that the masters are very interested in that. They want that. And it certainly has been my whole inner direction around this. That's important. And it's not the only way, certainly, just as even being a sannyasi or being a renunciant in the outer sense is the only way. You know, originally in India, the rishis were man and wife. They were married. And that was the common thing. And when the Buddha came along, he was strongly oriented towards renunciation. That actually influenced Hinduism. They did have renunciants, but it gave added impetus into Hinduism to take on the life of the renunciation, especially early in life. And then when Adi Shankaracharya came along, he was from an early childhood, he was just born with tremendous wisdom and accomplished everything. I think he's 32 Larry, or something like that, 28 or 32, and he's just had this long-lasting impact. He's just been one of these remarkable personalities. And he was a strong renunciant and encouraged others and reorganized the Swami order to be that way. And so there's just this whole focus, and of course the Catholic Church has that with the priesthood, that takes you to a higher level. There are many other religions, of course, where priests are married and that kind of thing, ministers are married. But this idea that marriage plays a second place, a back seat to the life of the renunciant, and that everything can be attained within a marital relationship. And I think that's wonderful. It's very life-affirming.
Yeah, and you said it's in a marital relationship.
No, marital.
Oh, that's why you said marital.
Could be that, too.
Well, it's interesting that the Hindu deities, Rama and Krishna, were both married. Both had caused, it's a marriage relationship.
Right. Well, they were both married. And so that is very much part of their tradition. That's been kind of, surpassed by the focus on renunciation. Papa was saying he'd like to reincarnate again as a woman and be a householder and show that was possible. He wanted to give energy to that. He wanted to give validity. Because there's also, amongst Brahmins in India, there's a thing about women not being able to get realization. So Papa totally swept that aside. Said nothing doing.
But it seems like many of the great teachers have had a consort or a woman who was their spiritual partner. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking even Mataji and Papa, I think of them in that way, that how is it different in, aside from any physical relationship, and whoever else, I don't know,
No, that's very, very common. Aurobindo had the mother, mm-hmm. and go down a long list of that. And it's true, and I think that most of us recognize that having that, there's a balance that's created that way. And
even Babaji. Even Babaji had a sister in that great moment when he declared his intention to stay in a body. His sister was there.
Yes.
So in that great moment, there was a balance.
So it's just so, there's many things moving about this visit that I received from Yogananda. I tell you, I don't know how to convey, you have, and you all know, you've had wonderful experiences, and you go to put it into words, and nothing translates it into the reality that you had. But what a tremendous soul Master is, what a tremendous soul, just beyond comprehension. Magnificent. And it was so lovely because Mother's relationship to him, I went to look at Mother a couple of times and it was as if I couldn't do it. She was pushing my vision back to him and her attention was on him too. So it's just a wonderful time that we had. Sometimes that hermitage cabin got a little crowded.
Master and his greater self. Thank you for sharing those stories with us, David, because I find especially the last number of experiences that you shared with us, that I feel an inner thrill that can only be a small part of what you must feel actually experiencing it, but it translates through to us.
I wanted to share, as I say, it's both personal and it also has the moral around intuitions and when you get intuitions and and oftentimes the question comes up, how do you know whether an intuition is true or not? And ultimately it comes down to the purity of your own consciousness and self-awareness, which you know about yourself, when you know that's coming from absolutely God and when it's coming from your own mental constructs, or it's coming from your own emotions, or it's coming from your own desire nature. It's not easy. And we need to be rigorous. We need to be scientific about it. We can't just run off with every little thing that crosses our mind as if that's coming directly from God. But if we are rigorous and we do focus our mind and look for the highest, look for confirmation for it, that we can begin to sort out and we begin to know ourselves. That's something I can feel that's coming from a clinging on, you know, some desire or some fear or some lower nature there that's reaching out for that. I can feel that. Or this is coming from a very pure place and unarguably, and oftentimes comes in contradiction to what we actually think. And that's tough, that's our challenge, that's our test when it comes that way. But it's necessary then to stick with it and to keep testing it until we come to peace with it, even if it's something other than how we think life ought to be, or how our lives ought to be, or how things ought to be. And by taking it back to God and never giving up on that until we feel that certainty, we feel that clarity come to us. And the beautiful thing about that is that that supports our sadhana. You know, it's taking things to God, it's putting our mind on God, it's putting our mind on that higher consciousness and aligning ourselves with that. And so by doing that, you are doing your sadhana. And as I say, we need the utmost purity with that. We need the utmost, and the purer the mind gets, the more open and receptive it is to these intuitions coming from the highest consciousness. But really, it's coming to us all the time. Are we receptive to it? Do we have our hearts and our minds open to it? Are we getting still inside to where we can listen? Because if we're full of chatter, the mind, the senses, everything going on, we don't hear it, not because it's not coming to us, but because we're not in a position to be receptive. Master said a beautiful thing about Sri Yukteswar, what a perfect instrument he was for wisdom, because he is so still, absolutely still. He had that placid mind that was just mirror, and whatever came from the highest consciousness, he was able to receive and to act on. And that's the other part of it, is acting on it. We can get intuitions. Do we act on it? Do we move with it? And if we don't, we tend to close it off. And of course, it throws our life out of harmony as well. And so, learning to be an instrument, both being receptive and letting it come through us, through our actions, through our words, through our thoughts. And this is no 10-minute course, you know. It's not being the perfect devotee in 10 minutes or less. It's practice, it's purity, it's refinement. It's making mistakes along the way, but learning from the mistakes, getting back on track again. It's living the life. That's how we do it. It's a wonderful line from the movie of Princess Bride where he says, life is pain, princess. Anybody who tells you different is trying to sell you something. Of course, Buddha said the same thing, but the nature of the pain is our separation. He didn't add in the selling part. He might have if he had thought about it.
Well, David, as you surrender and look for that inner guidance from God about everything, one way that I've kind of been able to sort it out is that if it's the spiritual way, the right way, I always just have this wellspring of joy. And so that is like, that's my answer.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's not the right thing, and that's a value statement, I realize, but then I don't feel good inside.
It's all right. We accept values around here.
Yeah. But, you know, it's like, if it's not right, yeah. it doesn't feel good inside.
Right.
And I really listen to that. And the thing that I'm learning is that eventually every single thing, you're directed by God.
Right.
And so I have had the experience of having all of these conversations with myself,
mm-hmm.
saying, you don't need to do that. You don't need to, whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be quiet now. Don't, you know. And it's like a continuous dialogue with God.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's
wonderful.
It makes, well, it gives you great peace.
Yeah.
I like to say, though, that when Arjuna was on the battlefield, he did not feel right about doing his dharma that he was called to do. He was in great turmoil, and Krishna...
He's being crucified. And in that, and Jesus didn't feel great joy during the Garden of Gethsemane about going and becoming the sacrificial lamb.
So I think there needs to be some discrimination. Lots of things feel good, and I better not do it.
Absolutely. It's not a does it feel good, do it kind of thing. And that's part of the test. That's what we have to be very exacting about. But also, in the story of Arjuna, is he takes it to Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take that inside, it's that place inside that doesn't know, but is devoted. Arjuna is very devoted, but he doesn't know, and he's having this great conflict. And what does he do with that? He turns to Krishna, and he says, help clarify this. And that starts the whole dialogue in the Gita. And that's essential. If he just dropped his arms and walked away, the Gita wouldn't happen. So when we do feel that confusion, or that uncertainty, or that flux kind of coming together and together, and we can't get any clarity about that. That's when we have to go inside and turn to that Kutastha Chaitanya consciousness here at the Ajna, that Christ, that Krishna consciousness. And we have to beat those doors down. We have to ask the question until we get the answer. And it doesn't always come in a second. There's been things that I've wondered about, and I've put the question out there. And it's been days, weeks, months, years sometimes before the answer comes back. There's other times when the spontaneous flow is just right there. And the more we're able to make ourselves into a receptive instrument, not toward our own desire, we start to learn. But that feels like Matthew was saying, if it's desire nature, it's got this kind of grasping quality to it. It's anxious. It's uncertain. It doesn't have peace. It doesn't have joy. And so when we test things, we test it until we feel that direct connection with God. And when we do that, we feel an inner stillness. We get to that inner stillness. And whether the inner stillness comes and then we get the information, or whether the information comes and it just settles us out, either way, we feel that connection with God and we feel that rightness. So I was talking about in my own story, is especially important decisions, big decisions, test it until you get to that point where you have that absolute clarity, that absolute certainty. And as I say, the beautiful thing about that is also our sadhana. You're putting your mind on God, you're putting your attention on God, you're taking the whole thing to Him, and you're working through all the different attachments or layers or ignorance or uncertainty, but you're taking it all to that highest consciousness. And when you do that, you're practicing your sadhana. So it works perfectly with our path. And it doesn't always come in a moment, but we have to be very rigorous that we go to that place where we come to that place where we feel that purity. And then we can act on it, but even as we act on it, we can still be checking it out. Does this feel right? Does this still have that sense of purity to it? Because the mind can come in there and begin to put a little twist on things. It can change things around a little bit. And I remember when I was first getting upliftment of consciousness and upliftment of mind, and it would be so clear to me in that uplifted state. And then as I started coming down from that state, the closest thing I could think of is like a dream. When you wake up and you have that really good total recall on a dream, but as you come and start to wake up a little bit more and wake up to the world, it starts to recede, and all the details aren't quite there in the same way, and you can't remember quite everything about it. And the mind can come in and start to fill in some gaps. And it can put its own little twist. And I think we see that with many people who follow religions, that they get some kind of upliftment, they get some kind of an experience. But they overlay their own biases, they overlay their own consciousness on it, and suddenly it gets twisted and it changes. And something that could have come from a very pure source suddenly gets contaminated with the mind. And so full realization only comes with this absolute purity of the mind. Until then, we get this mixed nature. And we, you know, there's no avoiding it. We can't start out at the end. We have to start out exactly where we're at. And so we have to start out there, and we have to work with what we have and work with it and work with it. But all of that work is purifying the mind. So it's all fulfilling ourselves. I think the quest for truth is one of the greatest avenues towards God. I want to know the truth. I don't want to take in an idea because somebody else said it, or I read it, or even that I kind of intuitively have a hunch that that's right. I want to know it. I want to know it in every cell of my being.
This is more than just an intellectual thing.
Much more than an intellectual thing, and much more than an intuitive hunch that comes and goes. It's absolute knowledge that comes through experience and the purity of that consciousness, and that we continue to seek that out until we have it. And that's a very powerful motivation to get to God and full realization. And that's where I don't see that doubt is a problem. Doubt can be used. Doubt is really my demand to know the truth. I want to know the truth. If we just stay with doubt, then that can become a block, because that can become a mental attitude that we actually block off the truth. We really don't think that we can get it. But if we use that doubt and we say, this is my demand to know the truth, I'm in ignorance here. I don't know the whole thing. I have some lovely ideas about it, and I've read about some things about what other people think. So I have an idea about things, but I want to know the truth. And that's been a very important part of my own self. Not wanting to know the bliss of God. Yeah. Those have been my two most powerful motivators for finding God and knowing God. And to know that joy, to know that peace, that bliss. Thoughts, comments, questions?
I have a question, and I'll just back up this whole thing about 100 paces. I had this very clear bell ring and say, you need to go to India in January. And then the bell stopped ringing, and then the doubt started to come in, and lots and lots and lots of good reasons that I shouldn't go, and lots of signs that I shouldn't go.
Right.
And so where do I go with that in a kind of a step by step by step?
Right. Right. When you felt that direction to go,
mm-hmm.
what did that feel like inside?
Absolute knowledge and yeah. truth.
When you feel those doubts and those good reasons for not going, do you feel that same absolute knowledge?
No.
And truth?
No.
So it's not that you ignore those other things, that's fine. But keep taking it back until you get an answer that also represents the same absolute knowledge. there are times when you can be directed to go in a certain direction, and you start taking some movement in that direction, and you get so far down the road, and suddenly the direction goes someplace else. Now, if we only have a mental concept that this is it, I have to do that, we quit listening. So rather than say, well, all those other reasons or doubts or whatever, I have to just ignore those and keep going, what I would suggest is you go back to that same source and you keep asking the question and you keep going inside until you have that same certainty, that clarity of purpose. And whatever the answer is, then you accept that as your inner direction at that time. I'm not a... Signs present a lot of difficulties. Because one of the things we can be almost certain of, whenever we start anything, and this is any kind of project, a worldly project, a spiritual project, any kind of intention of will. And I would almost say that the greater the light that's represented by that, the greater the opposition is going to come. And so if every time some opposition comes, we say, well, I guess God doesn't want me to do this, we're never going to do anything because we're always going to get that opposition. If every time some opposition comes, we say, well, I guess God doesn't want me to do this, we're never going to do anything because we're always going to get that opposition. And I'm quite certain Mother would support me on that one. She had a tremendous will. But also to honor that place, and as I say, it becomes part of your sadhana, to take it back and demand that same clarity, demand that same divine purpose, that purity of consciousness, and that's what you want. So take it back, take it back, take it back, until you get that same inner direction, one way or the other.
It's not been my experience that I can get that.
Mm-hmm.
It's been my experience that these things come out of the blue. These bell-ringing things come out of the blue.
It's not true. Oftentimes, well, for instance, we have the habit of meditating every morning. Some mornings are just terrible. Our mind is racing from here to there. We feel anxious. We are preoccupied with things that are coming in the world. We get all kinds of interference. And we think, oh my gosh, I'm not even sure. I think maybe I just wasted my time in meditation there. But later on in the day, suddenly we're doing something, and suddenly we just feel filled up with some peace, some joy, some bliss. There is a cause and effect relationship for the effort that we made before to what we're getting later. And we don't always see the cause and effect relationship because it doesn't always coincide time-wise exactly with when we think that we're making the effort. So sometimes it seems like we're making the effort and we're not getting the result, and that things just come out of the blue. But I don't think that that's true. I think that there's a correlation, and if you could see the inner workings and how that's going, you would see that the effort is directly related to what you're getting. So the mind looks for that connection. It says, I don't get it. I wasn't meditating and that just came to me. And I knew it. But if you could see the more subtle underlying patterns, you would see how your effort from earlier fed into that experience and having that experience. And it helped to purify your mind to where you were receptive. Even though you don't see the exact correlation between cause and effect. So make the effort and you'll get the results. More sadhana.
surprise.
And we don't have to, I mean, one thing is, it's we don't have to get a furrowed brow. We don't have to give ourselves a headache, you know, from, oh, I gotta think so hard, I gotta concentrate on this so hard. become soft towards God. Become receptive. Become open. Become trusting. And just open yourself and say, I don't know how to make these decisions, and I don't know how to make intuition come to me. All I can do is turn my mind onto you and open myself to your direction. You have to come to me. Now, it's a wonderful thing that Jesus says. I stand at the door and knock. Those who open the door, they'll come in. It's up with them. That consciousness is standing at the door. It's knocking. All we have to do is become receptive. We have to open the door. And it's just our own internal receptivity. And we don't know how it's going to come. We don't know when it's going to come. We don't know where it's going to take us. And that's where the ego gets nervous. You know, it wants to hold onto those reins pretty tight. So if you can let go of the reins and say, all right, I'm opening myself to you. Become soft, become receptive. Become like a friend. You need to show me this. I don't know how this all works, so you need to show me. I want to understand. You've got my attention, and I, you know, I'm giving you my full attention here. And so then that becomes the key, is our sincerity, our openness, our receptivity.
David, when you set a goal and you decide you want to go towards it and you put out the effort, then you get the opposition. Why mm-hmm. doesn't God do the opposite and support you at that point?
Well, you know, we're facing ourselves, so it's not what God is giving us in terms of opposition. It's just the nature of duality. And so God is giving you support. One of the things that he showed me one time that I thought was most wonderful. If you've ever thought about a time in your life, things were really tough, really tough. And later on you look back on it, or you look at somebody else's life who's really tough. I don't know how they survived. I don't know how I survived. How did I do it? And what God showed me is that at any particular moment, you have sufficient grace coming to you to meet the challenges of life. Now, this doesn't necessarily guarantee outward success. It's not about, it's inward success. And it's inward strength, and it's inward will and determination and grace and direction. And all of that is coming to you. And you have sufficient power and strength and direction in order to meet whatever is coming your way. You have that every moment. Every one of us has that every moment. And one of the reasons why we can look back on our life and say, I had all this to deal with. How did I do it? I don't think I could do it today. We don't need that grace in that moment, so we're not aware of it. But if that situation never came up in our life, or again, or something like it, we would have, again, sufficient grace in order to get through it. It's flowing to us all the time. So whenever we need it, we don't, and what that means is we don't ever have to have any fear about it. We have sufficient grace to meet everything that comes to us. And as I say, sometimes that means outward success. Sometimes outwardly, it may result in a failure, but if we stay attuned to God, that failure turns into something else, another opportunity. Sometimes you lose a job, for instance, and something better comes along. You don't know that in the moment. But later on, you realize, you know, if I was still working at that other place, I wouldn't have been available for this. And so, in a strange way, you know, it all begins to work for you. Beyond your own reasoning. Doesn't mean we don't have uncomfortable moments. But when we live in that faith and that understanding, we can draw on that inner power and that strength.
Does that mean that when you see the opposition, you know what the opposition is, that you always have the inner resource to overcome it as you see it in terms of being able to resolve to the opposite?
You have sufficient grace to overcome it within you. You have sufficient grace to stay attuned to God in every moment and listen to that direction. And that is overcoming this world. As Jesus said, if my kingdom were of this world, I could have thousands of angels here to help me in this moment. My kingdom is not of this world. It's an inner world. It's an inner consciousness. and you have sufficient grace and resources to give you that power of upliftment to rise above whatever circumstances you find yourself.
This is not to say that bad guys don't win outwardly sometimes.
They absolutely do. You know, we saw an example of that in New York City and Washington, D.C. But look at the response. The prayer vigils, the candles, the pulling together of people. There is sufficient grace, direction, power to meet whatever comes to us.
David, could you explain just a little bit in terms of the use of householder, and is that synonymous with being married, or are there other aspects to householder as it's used in India within the path?
Yeah. It's usually used in contradistinction to the sannyasi life, the renunciant who owns no property, who takes a vow of celibacy, and sometimes they're part of institutions, sometimes they take up a wandering life. Mm-hmm. So swamis, sannyasis, in this culture it'd be priests, and officially they own nothing, they possess nothing. And the householder then lives more in the world. Most often they have a job, wife, children. That's not always the case, but they're fully engaged in the world in a way that the renunciant is not. And so the householder is seen as that.
The hard part for the householder is not to get too enmeshed in all that stuff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's oftentimes why the sannyasi is seen as a higher path, as a higher calling. Because they're willing to focus their whole attention and throw themselves completely on the trust of God to go where he tells them to go and not bother to take any money and no plans and nothing else. Whereas householders, it's more incumbent, especially if you have dependents, that you have to do some planning around all of that, and you have property and all that kind of thing. And so oftentimes it was seen, and still is seen, that the sannyasi has a higher calling. And Larhari Mahasaya came at Babaji's request, where he was married at the time, but he had no children. He came back in a high state of consciousness of Nirvikalpa Samadhi, and he was a demonstration that it was not necessary to enter into the sannyasin life in order to have this highest perfected consciousness.
Kirtaswar also.
Sri Yukteswar was married earlier in his life. Later, when Babaji gave him the title of Swamiji, and later on after that, he officially took vows around that. Master was an exception, but Master came to this country and had a great work to do. It was a necessary thing to do. But they're also very interested in seeing that the householder life is supported and seen as just as valid. Ramakrishna, who was married, but really groomed some sannyasin devotees and encouraged them to be in an unmarried state, but he said, you know, it's easier to fight the battle from the fortress, and the fortress is the family home. Because they see that not all sannyasins live up to the high ideals. They get caught up in ego, they get caught up in all kinds of things that maybe if they just lived, I might think of as an average life, they would actually do much better. They'd be more balanced. And Mother, of course, was a wonderful example of somebody who lived in the world, worked in the world, was married, had children, and was raised up to a very, very high state of consciousness, the highest. And that's hope for all of us.
Sometimes one wonders if a sannyasin would hold up as well under the stresses and cares of a householder.
Yeah. And there are times, and my own life is like that. There's a time of being pulled away from society, spending a year of silence and seclusion. But if that's necessary for you, God can arrange for it. And his mother said, well, what if somebody goes through these experiences, Papa, in the West, and they don't have you? So God will surely take care of them. And I think my own life is a reflection of that. You know, I've been able to live, and thanks to all of your support and love and kindnesses, that my life has gone very well. And it's allowed me the opportunity to pursue the sadhana and to teach and to do God's will. I think God will take care of us. And so we never need to have a fear. If there's a time when we need that seclusion, if there's a time when we need to be taken out of the world for a period of time, God will arrange for all of that. And so we don't need to worry about things before they happen. Just to live our lives the best of our ability, keep our mind focused on God. There's a wonderful story about Narayan, who's a disciple of Krishna. And he kind of was getting a little bit full of himself. He kind of thought he was okay. He chanted God's name all day, every night, all night long, never slept, was just imbued with God. And so he went to Krishna one time and he says, you know, is there any devotee greater than me? And he really, he meant it. He thought he was right there at the top. And Krishna says, well, actually, there is one. And he was shocked to hear that. He says, well, I'd love to meet him. You know, I want to see him. He must be wonderful. And so Krishna gave him his address and directions to get to him. And so he goes and he sees him. And he secretly observes him. This man lived in a very small hut. He had his wife and some children. He got up in the morning and he chanted God's name once. He went out. He worked all day. Inwardly, he was surrendering and he was serving God all day long, but no one would ever know from any outward circumstance. He got home at night, he had worked hard all day long, he chanted God's name once, and he went to sleep and slept soundly for 8 hours. Woke up the next morning and did the same thing. Narayana could not believe it. Could not believe it. Here he's doing all this sadhana, he's chanting God's name 24 hours a day, and this man's greater than he is. So he went to Krishna and he said, I don't know. I think you're a little bit off on this one. And so Krishna gave him a task to do. A very difficult task, a complicated task. And when he came back, Krishna said, how many times did you think of me while you were doing that task? Well, I couldn't, you know. I was involved in doing this task. I couldn't be chanting your name or thinking about you then. See, this man never forgets me. Never forgets me. Whatever is going on in his life, he never forgets me. And so his mother taught us so beautifully, so simply, but so powerfully, keep the mind on God always, however that happens. Chanting God's name, loving God, serving God, however that happens. Make your mind totally fused upon the divine until you feel that bliss, joy, the peace, that inner direction and intuition that becomes your all and all and all. And when you totally surrender to Him, moving as He moves, you know, you're like a sailboat. Wherever the wind puffs along, there you go, there you go. No preconceptions, no idea other than service, other than moving where God wants you to move. And then you are free. Free. There's no outer form. There's nothing that inhibits your freedom. Live in that freedom. Breathe that freedom. You are that freedom. And when we've done that, then we can know that we have arrived. Sri Yukteswar used to say, God is never-ending, ever-new bliss and joy. And when we have that in our being, we live that. That's sufficient. There's nothing else. There's nothing else that we need. And then we just go according to how God directs us.
How is it that that state's accomplished? Of like throughout my day, if I'm driving or if I'm working or something, and my mind comes on God and I concentrate very strongly on that.
Yeah.
I'll just be completely thrusted in to kind of a meditative state, or kind of a very peaceful and maybe blissful kind of thing, and to then concentrate on the worldly things, which I need to be doing at the time,
right,
becomes almost impossible.
It's sadhana, it's more practice.
It's just
more. And what happens is that that awareness, when you feel that bliss, when you feel that joy, you know that that's God. When you are doing a task, you do some very intensive, high task at your work, you don't know that that's God. And that's the problem. You lose that awareness as you get in tune with your body. But imagine that as you do that, you could feel God flowing through you as your own life energy. As the thoughts direct you, and you're consciously aware that that's God who's directing you, who's moving through you, who's the life energy, everything. He's the customers, he's the machinery, he's everything. And when you have that awareness, then there is no separation. No separation. And you don't get caught up in the world in the same way. You're active in the world, you're acting in the world. It doesn't mean that you don't experience things of the world, but none of them overshadow that underlying knowledge that this is God living his life through you. And that is sadhana, that is practice, and bringing your mind back to that again and again. So one of the ways you can do that is when you have to make that shift, allow yourself to see that life energy flowing through you as activity, and the thoughts flowing through you as focused on those activities. And just practice as much as you can, seeing that and feeling that as God moving through you. So you do everything that you've always done, but there's a part of you who holds back and is the observer and watching, and you feel and affirm to yourself, this is God living his life through me. And when you have that, it's such joy, it's such peace. You operate outwardly, some people may not notice any difference at all, but you experience a tremendous difference inside. And so that's what draws you into it even more and more and more. And you want that more. It's a very positive attraction. And as that positive attraction picks up, just naturally you want to be in that all the time. And you're terribly heartsick when you're not in that. You miss it. And it doesn't come without a price, as Mother says. It's the pearl of great price. And so inwardly, we have to be willing to surrender everything. All our attachments, all our desires, everything. And inwardly attune to how that life moves through us. We give up our ideas, and we attune to how the divine moves in us. And as you know, that's not always easy to do. It's a big challenge. Mm-hmm. But that's it.
Meditation has a way of fooling you with that too. So natural to surrender then in the middle of your day, it's not so easy.
Yeah, it is. We get caught. Yeah. And that's why many times the sannyasin, the renunciant, is seen as the superior way, because it gives you that opportunity to be away from the world. But they too have to learn how to be in the world but not of it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they get wonderfully proficient at being in a cave and being in peace. But the minute they step out of their cave, they get caught. They get angry, they get this, they get that. And they're caught right back in the mind again. Mm-hmm. So they still have to do the work.
It's a good start, though.
It is a good start. And that's why we have our own meditation cave, mm-hmm, that we enter into every day. And let the world go away. We have to create that space. We have to create that intention to push and let the world out of it, from its constant demands, and go inside and reside in that inner stillness. And when we learn that more and more, we're able to take that into our daily lives.
David, what is the movement from maybe it sounds egotistical to talk about that, but like, as as a nurturer, as a caregiver for the family, and so on and so forth. You know, it's been said of me, oh, what a big heart I have. And I'm still very caring.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a much more objective, dispassionate caring. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to put that, but mm-hmm. it's like this thing that happened on the 11th, this event that happened on the 11th. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think it was terrible. Yes, I think it was a tragedy. But in general, I have been very unmoved by it. And I've had to look at that.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point I did cry, but it was based upon the emotion of the people and all. It's like this is just God's play. It's mm-hmm. the things that are going on, and there's good that will come of it.
There's only one test that we need to have. And we can go in and we can say, do I feel connected with God? Now, if we're in a dissociated state, that we're in shock, or we've somehow put a shroud around us that we're not going to let anything affect us and that kind of thing, and we go in and say, am I connected with God? Do I feel my... We're not going to feel anything. We're going to feel a blank, a void. So it's not a dissociated state. But we can be in a very impersonal state, and we can feel guilty or feel the call to, well, I should be more caring, or I should react stronger to this. And that's just an ego overlay. That's old stuff. God is plenty loving. He's plenty compassionate. And if he wants to show that through you, he will. And if he wants to bring some other gift through you, the clarity that this is all his play, and all of that kind of thing, and you go inside and you say, well, let me do an analysis here. Am I blocked from God? Am I blocked from the life around me? And if you feel open towards God and you feel open towards life, and this is just how God is expressing himself, then that means letting go of that attachment to having to cry or to feel this huge outpour of compassion or whatever. And let God express himself. One of the big traps that we can get into as we get into God experience is we have a certain experience. Maybe we have this tremendous sense of peace. Oh, I want that all the time. And we actually find ourselves grasping onto it. That grasping on actually begins to choke off the very life that makes that peaceful experience come in the first place. And so God may come as peace. He may come as joy at another time. He may come as just kind of the nothingness of God. You're just in total stillness. Millions and billions of ways and experiences that he can come. And if we get attached to just one way, we block all those other ways, and we quit experiencing that one way, by the way. I only want God in that brand. And it comes in lots of different ways. And so that's an inner attachment. That's a spiritual attachment. And letting go of that can be a tough one.
Was this what is meant as the observer?
Yes. You watch things come. Oh, there's that peace. Now God is coming as this tremendous energy, like a storm blowing through me. And again, as... Well, there he is, just a trickle of joy. It just makes me smile, and it's just bubbling up inside of me, and I can't contain myself from laughing. And then another time, just being totally indrawn and in peace. And another time, you're in action, and you're feeling the flow of God flow through you. There's unending ways for that expression, but it all has the sense of that purity and that joy and that inner connection. That's what's the same. And that's the sat, the eternal existence. Chit, the awareness, that's the witness. Always being aware of what God is doing through you, the consciousness, the intelligence flowing through you. And ananda, and that's the feeling. And those three things, the sat is always the same. Always the same. The ananda is always ananda, but it's always changing. It's like one of those fountains that goes up, comes down, different lights come on it, music comes on it. It's ever in play. It's always changing, never ending, delightful. And when we learn to value those things, we learn to step back. I'm not the doer here. I'm the witness. I'm watching what's happening through me and in me and all around me. And isn't this fabulous? Isn't this a wonderful play? And when we can live life that way, we are truly free. We're truly free. And we enjoy everything, but we're not attached to anything. It comes, it goes, high, low, pain, pleasure, bliss. It's all God. That's how He's choosing to express Himself through us in a particular moment. And we are free. Jiva Mukta. Jiva is the soul, Mukta is freedom. I haven't asked him. I have asked him. Yes, Larry's going to do the ceremony.
But he's already married.
The Swami Vishwananda, I understand. Life is fun. And Sirius, Master says, this world is God's hobby, but He takes that hobby very seriously. When we pay attention to God and we make Him first, always, then we can relax and we can have fun and it's joyful. We know what? We know when we're on track and we know when we're off track. So it's to live in that joy and that peace and that bliss always. Oh, Heavenly Father.
Oh, Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
I feel the wonder and beauty.
Of Thy glorious presence.
Of Thy glorious presence.
In every part of my being.
In every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
And surrender myself to Thee.
And surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with Thee.
Of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Such great love for you all. And to me, it is bliss to come together. And thank you for bringing your part of God, your light, your love, your service, through recent events, it is proof positive that this world is in such need of good examples of those who are dedicated to the light, to living the life. In the long run, it is the only way to combat the darkness, angers, hatreds, bitterness. To give love, to live the life in light, and to be the example of what we should be as God's very own. And I pray that you have the greatest of strength, clarity, and determination in being a beacon of light to all whom your life comes into contact with, and spreading beyond to help this world find its potential and all that it is in God. May it be ever so.